2024. And we're going to start with the modifications bill, and I'm going to let our vice chair, Senator Potts, chair.
All right, we have our first agenda item, SF-4307, Chair Pappas.
This is, that's correct. I guess on Tuesday we never adopted the A3 amendment, and that was the one that we had discussed very thoroughly on Tuesday. So I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Chair Pappas moves the A3 amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment A3 passed or is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Then we have the A6 amendment. So only three projects came in since our meeting. There are still some other projects pending. So if anyone listening has a project, they're just kind of in process. We are going through a process where the chair and the other body and I agree on an amendment and MMB signs off on them. So it's a very thorough process. So a couple other things haven't quite made their way through that that process. But we hope then to be able to add those in finance. And for those of you who aren't on finance, we'll be sure to let you know what those additional ones are. So Ms. James is going to explain the A6 amendment.
Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, on the A6 lines 1.3, and this amends the A3. On lines 1.3 to 1.4 is a correction to the title to eliminate an errant reference to some appropriation bonds, which are not affected in the bill. Lines 1.5 through 1.18 add a modification to the Conway Rec Center appropriation, providing for the money to be used not on the renovation of an existing structure, but on the construction of a new structure or the expansion of an existing structure, and also to allow site improvements that include traffic management and outdoor courts. Lines 1.19 to 1.20 are an addition to the appropriation for the new Native Theater. This adds a location for that project. Lines 1.21 is an addition of the word renovate for the Walker West project. Lines 1.22 through the end of that first page, 1.31 is an addition of the modifications for the Buell project. This allows the money to be used on publicly owned water infrastructure, even if it's not new, and it also adds water storage systems. On page 2, line 2.1 adds the word design for the Cologne project. Lines 2.2 through the end of the amendment are an addition of the Camp Ripley project. This extends that appropriation to 2025.
Madam Chair, if there aren't any questions, then I would move the A6 amendment to the amendment.
Chair Pappas moves the A6 amendment to the amendment. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment to the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I don't think we asked if there was any testimony on Tuesday, so maybe you could just see if there's anyone who wanted to comment on anything.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. To the SF-4307, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to this bill? Come forward if you would. Seeing no one coming forward, let's see here.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 4307 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
The SF-4307 is recommended to be passed and passed out of committee to finance. as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It is passed.
Thank you very much, members. We're going to take a break, and I think we're waiting for Senator Hochschild, who has two bills. Susan, you can come back. He's not quite ready. Sure, I have my cheat sheets. Yeah, we're going to do the manufactured housing.
We're going to go ahead and move on to SF-3232, Chair Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd just like to invite the testifiers to come forward, if they would. This Senate File 3232 is a cooperative manufactured housing infrastructure grant program. The bill would create the cooperative manufactured housing infrastructure grant program and appropriate $10 million in bond proceeds to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for grants under this program. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency would disperse grants to cities and counties to provide a maximum of 50% of the capital costs of public infrastructure necessary for an eligible cooperative manufactured housing development project. A city or county would not be allowed to receive more than $60,000 per manufactured housing lot. The program is designed to encourage cities to invest in manufactured homes and the workforce the tenants represent, ultimately helping cities expand their tax bases and Minnesotans build equity where not previously possible. So here I have to speak on the bill is Joel Hansen, the Advocacy and Communications Manager with North Country Cooperative Foundation. Before we do that, though, it looks like there is an amendment. And Madam Chair, then this is a staff amendment, I believe, so I'd like to move the A1 amendment, author's amendment.
Chair Pappas moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hansen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joel Hansen. I'm the Communications and Advocacy Manager at North Country Cooperative Foundation. Pleasure to be before you today. So as Senator Pappas has already stated, the idea behind this bill is to create what we would consider to be a new workforce home ownership model in the state of Minnesota. It comes as no surprise to you that we have an issue in regards to affordable workforce home ownership opportunities in this state, and really what it comes down to is a lack of supply. And so as cities look to try to innovate, what we view this bill as doing is incentivizing cities to look at different home type structures as well as a different ownership model, the cooperative model, to be able to get at deeper affordability, to allow for ownership and equity building opportunities for working families across the state. And so what this does is it basically allows for cities to apply for dollars related to the infrastructure for specifically manufactured or facility-built homes. In addition to that, it allows for the cooperative model to be used in this case, which would be basically bifurcating the home from the land, getting at deeper affordability. And so what we think this would do is allow for home ownership for 60% of AMI, which right now is a rarity that you see across the affordable housing spectrum. We also have an additional testifier, Galen.
Yes, on Zoom.
Yep, on Zoom.
I think it's Galen Malecha, County Commissioner from Rice County. Looks like he's ready
Correct.
To go.
Galen Malecha, Rice County Commissioner here. Yes, thank you for having me today. I serve as a Rice County Commissioner. In addition to my role as a County Commissioner, I also serve on the Rice County and the City of Northfield Housing and Redevelopment Authority. In these multiple roles, I have seen firsthand the need for more affordable housing, not just in our community here of Rice County, but across the southern Minnesota region and the state. Especially in the greater Minnesota, we have seen a severe shortage of workforce housing that is affordable housing for working families. Additionally, the options that do exist for this type of housing in our community are typically not ownership based. Thus, we find ourselves with a missing middle of affordable workforce housing, home ownership opportunities that has a cascading effect across the region. A shortage of local workers, less kindergartners enrolling in our community schools, and an increasingly squeezed tax base. So as we work to remedy this situation, we must think outside the box in how we envision workforce housing. Today's legislation aims to do just that. While municipalities have a desire to innovate, often those innovations in the housing sector come with barriers. Unfamiliarity with the home type, misconceptions regarding ownership structures, and differing infrastructure needs. However, when incentivized, exists for communities to explore new models of housing, particularly workforce home ownership, those barriers begin to disappear. Further, as Minnesota looks at the housing crisis as a whole, perhaps one of the largest gaps in our approach is the lack of affordable ownership opportunities. Particularly for the first generation home buyers, programs that encourage the development of affordable ownership and allow for Minnesotans to build equity are sorely needed, and this proposal accomplishes that. In conclusion, as we try to tackle the housing crisis on a local level, we need as many options in the affordable housing toolbox as possible. We also need programs that incentivize municipalities to explore new methods of housing, whether that be new construction types or ownership types. The desire for doing something different is there. Municipalities just need help in removing the obstacles to do so. This program would help accomplish that goal, and I encourage its passage. Thank you, and I will stand if for any questions. Otherwise, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak before you today. We know that you're all aware of the housing crisis that does exist. So once again, any tools in the toolbox that can help municipalities and counties to march forward in producing these housing programs and affordable housing is greatly appreciated. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Dan Kitzberger.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the Legislative Director for Minnesota Housing. I can keep this very brief. We're still working with the stakeholders on this bill. It looks and feels an awful lot like a program that we passed or that was passed last legislative session that we're still standing up, but I understand that there's some concerns around kind of scalability and the potential size of projects and then also the per lot cost limit in that bill. And so these are things I think we can continue to work through and you know, I know the next stop is housing, right? And so, you know, we can reserve the bulk of our comments for there, but just appreciate the work of the stakeholders in continuing to engage with us on this.
Thank you. Chair Pappas, any comments before we go to questions or comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think questions? This probably should have gone to housing first, but for some reason it got referred to us, so it'll go to housing to kind of work out some of these details and then probably come back to us.
Okay, members, any questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. Commissioner Malika just expressed our concerns, obviously, in Rice County. There's lots of needs for this project, and I'm sorry I didn't read the bill enough, but so there's a lot of existing mobile home parks now, or manufactured home parks. Some of them, the land is owned by the developer, and the unit is owned by the person themselves, and I know a cooperative, they'd own a percentage in the whole thing, and then their own thing as well. Is the money available for some of these existing manufacturing home parks to convert to that a cooperative type, because I think there's a lot of mobile home or manufactured home parks out there that are substandard in their improvements, and if this money can upgrade them, and that may mean taking the density out, so you're reducing some units so it's not so compact, using that money to make them more attractive for the people that are doing that. So is the money available for this, or is it just new construction only?
Senator Pappas?
I'll turn it over to Mr. Hansen.
Okay, great. Thanks, Madam Chair. Senator Jasinski. So this program would be focused primarily just on new construction. And so what this is focused on is not necessarily the creation of new manufactured home parks, but the creation of a new neighborhood using facility-built homes. Whereas what you're discussing, there is some dollars that were passed by the legislature in 2023 for this exact purpose, the Manufactured Home Acquisition Fund, which is actually going to be housed at North Country Cooperative Foundation. We're currently in discussions with the agency on getting those dollars out the door. Once those dollars are allocated, we'd love to talk to you and the communities that are within your district about that, because there are resources available for that.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I think there's a lot of potential for new ones with new designs, but I think there's a lot of existing ones out there that could really be improved to make them more appealing, not only to the neighborhood around them, the surrounding properties, but to the owners themselves of the property. So I think it's great if we can do that, or if that works for that, and then as well as promoting the new ones, because I think, again, home ownership is probably the best way. And I used to own a lot of apartment buildings myself, but I think, you know, to be paying rent and not getting that equity back, it's really going to help our Minnesotans. If they can actually build equity, I think it's the number one equity building thing you can have in your personal finance. So I think it's a great project, and I look forward to seeing the results. But again, I think capturing and working on the existing manufacturing parks would really be beneficial as well. So thank you, and thank you for bringing the bill, Senator Pappas.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to actually echo some of those very same comments. And I heard your testifiers, Senator Pappas, talk about the importance of home ownership. That is the best generational wealth builder. And so I look forward to seeing that. I'm just wondering, I'm a little, I just need a little explanation on what the Senate File 3232, what the bond, the infrastructure grant program looks like. Is it infrastructure? Is the bonding for to pay for the infrastructure for, as I heard, new parks that are manufactured home parks? And so kind of explain that to me. And then the other question I have is about the home ownership. Who owns those individual manufactured housing in the development that you're hoping this bill would finance?
Chair Pappas or Mr. Hansen?
Yep, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. So to your first question, could you repeat that one sec?
Yes. What exactly is the funding, the state funding, yes, the private funding? What is that going to purchase?
Exactly. So the idea would be that it would fund municipally owned infrastructure within the community itself. So it'd be roads, streets, water lines, et cetera. So it'd be municipal infrastructure related to this new development. Like Mr. Kitzberger said previously, this is based largely off of a program that was passed last year related to the Greater Minnesota infrastructure, and I think there's a bill on the agenda today that touches on that. And then the second part of your question about who actually owns the home. So it'd be the individual that is living in that home that would own that home. The idea is the individual owns the home, and then they own a share in the cooperative that would own the land underneath their home. So think of it similar to maybe like a homeowners association. The idea would be that individuals would participate in that cooperative, elect a board of directors, have membership meetings, and have an ability to have a say in the management of their community within, you know, the larger community.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the explanation. So number one is the manufactured home itself is owned by the individual. However, it's on land, which is not solely owned by the individual. The land is owned as a cooperative.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Okay, and the funding is to pay for the infrastructure to build that manufactured home, to build the site.
The roads.
The roads, the bridges.
The sewer,
okay,
that stuff.
What, maybe, yeah, not bridges. Okay. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, it would hold down the cost further as well. The fact that the necessary infrastructure, mm-hmm, for the site is paid for through these bonds or their matching funds.
And okay. Madam Chair, a lot of times that infrastructure is paid for by the local community, the local city or county, and we know how difficult that is for local cities to create new neighborhoods, basically, because they just don't often have the resources. And many times they've come to us, the Capital Investment Committee, to help them with that infrastructure as well.
One final. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so thank you, Senator Pappas. So it's an innovative idea, mm-hmm, and I'm quite interested in it, but I just have one. You don't have, I'll just throw it out there and we can discuss it later. Something I'd want to perhaps, if we could try to avoid, we've seen this with some other manufactured home parks in the past, where actually the manufactured home, I have some constituents in this situation right now, own the manufactured home. However, they don't own the land. Mm-hmm. The land becomes increasingly valuable as perhaps the city grows out. And suddenly they can't afford to live in the home that they own because the cost of the land underneath that home is so expensive. So there must be a rent aspect to the land as well. And how does that figure in this situation?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I'll let Mr. Hansen address it, but that's the advantage of the cooperative over a private entity of some kind owning the land, in that since the cooperative is the group, they can kind of control the costs that individual homeowners would pay, you know, toward maintenance or like your condo fee.
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, Chair Pappas answered that question beautifully. I will just add that a cooperative essentially functions as a nonprofit. So there are no profits to be made on that. So to the extent that you're paying, you know, an annual, or it would be a monthly home ownership due, if you will, to the cooperative, that's going just to cover the basic maintenance of the land. And, you know, if you have, like, for instance, a shared area, like a park or something like that. So, yeah.
Okay. And then, one final question, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I'm just curious, has this approach been taken in any other states, and do we have any history to look back upon?
Mr. Hansen.
Yep. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. You know, Minnesota has over 100 senior housing cooperatives here currently, and so that is already a functional model here in the state. We actually lead the country in the amount of senior housing cooperatives that we have. As far as models elsewhere in the country for cooperative manufactured home parks, there's hundreds of those across the country. Minnesota, we have 11 currently. And then in addition to that, recently the federal government has issued some funding to incentivize the creation of new manufactured home communities as well. So this is kind of a part of, I would say, what is becoming increasingly a national push, not only for manufactured housing, but also for cooperatives.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kitzberger wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I was just going to mention perhaps, you know, how the program would function. You know, we would administer it at Minnesota Housing, and we would award funds on a competitive basis. So very similar to the way that we're going to run the Greater Minnesota Housing Infrastructure Program from last year, but also the other manufactured housing-related programs that we currently administer. And to Senator Jasinski's earlier point, we do currently administer a fund for the park-owned infrastructure, and we can help with the preservation of that as those parks are being converted into cooperatives. So we have some base funding for that. We got a really sizable increase last year, and we put that out on a competitive basis as well, typically at the end of the year. So that work is ongoing. We're going to be able to do more than we ever have previously because of the increase we got last year and the funds we were able to commit. But, you know, as part of our scoring process, I might add, you know, we do have a you know, kind of the latitude in place to consider things like longer-term affordability that we're able to do through our that we currently do through our co-op conversions. And so, you know, in consultation with stakeholders, should this program come our way, we can certainly talk through whether there's value in that.
Thank you. Senator Chudzinski, did you have a question?
Thank you, man. I think part of that got answered, but again, I just, you know, Senator Nelson was talking about the cost and things like that and the infrastructure, and what I'm hearing as well, and I think there's another bill traveling, and maybe you know about it, but same thing for single-family homes. I mean, it's gotten so expensive for wastewater, for curb gutter, all these things that these cities have money available to help entice people to get out single-family homes for sale, as well as the cooperatives is beneficial as well, because, again, seeing the cost recently, what that is very expensive. And then back to your question on the version of the manufacturing home. So what a lot of them are there now is there's a developer that did that. The individual homeowners own the manufactured home, but what happened is the income stream from that investment is what drives the value up. So all of a sudden you take the capitalization value of those incoming rents, and let's say it's $600 per site or $1,000 per site, you get that income coming in and it makes that land value go so high. And what we're also seeing is a lot of the developers that once they get used to that income stream, they don't want to make improvements. And that's where I think this money really helps. It uses money to make those improvements to make it better, you know, some of our aging manufacturing parks in the state. So, and then lastly, there's one other one. So I think there's a couple of them across the state that actually evolve these manufactured home areas came about in rural areas, so they're actually not connected to water and sewer. Okay. And I don't know if there's a way that you can use the funds to allow the developer to connect to water and sewer, which would improve, again, the water quality and all the environmental concerns we have with individual septic systems. I know there's one for sure in my district that, again, the developer is looking to work with the city to upgrade the wastewater so they can actually connect. And the distance to the wastewater is quite some distance. It's, you know, 5 or 6 miles long to connect. But that's another thing that we could use to help improve these manufacturing and let these cooperatives and things like that really show the homeownership increase. So thank you.
I want to acknowledge that Senator Muhammad is joining us virtually. Senator Pappas, Chair Pappas moves the A. Oh.
Wait, Madam Chair, I think
that's Madam Chair and Senator Jasinski, I was just going to add that connecting private parks to city infrastructure is something we can do currently through our manufactured home park redevelopment program. And in fact, we just did the city of Richfield. There's a park there that we connected to public infrastructure.
Chair Pappas moves the SF 3232 as amended to be recommended to pass and refer to the Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Oppose?
Aye.
And it is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe Senator Hochschild is here now, so I'll give you a break. Senator Hochschild, we have for you Senate File 4108. It is not officially in front of us. I believe it's still in another committee, but today is our policy day, so we thought we would go ahead and give it an informational hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I have for your consideration an informational hearing, Senate File 4108, a bill that establishes a Minnesota Advisory Council on Infrastructure. The Infrastructure Resiliency Advisory Task Force, created last session, was charged with evaluating issues related to coordination, sustainability, resiliency, and federal funding on state, local, and private infrastructure in the state. The task force has identified a number of weaknesses and inefficiencies related to infrastructure across the state, and therefore this bill proposes the establishment of the Minnesota Infrastructure Board to rectify these issues. This board would be charged with defining and maintaining a vision for the future of Minnesota's infrastructure that provides for proper management, coordination, and investment. The board will work in a non-regulatory capacity and in tandem with stakeholders to develop and promote best practices that will preserve and extend the longevity of Minnesota's public and privately owned infrastructure. The board will consist of 14 non-voting members that are experts in an aspect of infrastructure and 11 voting members. The duties of the board is charged with include, but are not limited to, identifying approaches to enhance and expedite infrastructure coordination across jurisdictions, agencies, state and local government, and public-private sectors, including in planning, design, engineering, construction, maintenance, and operation development, and educational programming on asset management. Thank you for taking time to hear the bill, and happy to take any questions.
Just looking for any questions from members. I have one, and that is, it's a very large board. And is there any particular reason why the council, whoever wrote the bill, yourself and whoever was working on this, decided it had to be, you know, so large? Every commissioner, bunch of legislators, local government, pretty, plus all kinds of asset management officials and experts. Seems a little unwieldy. Senator Hochschild.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a very good question, and I don't disagree with you necessarily. I think I don't know the direct answer, but I will try to answer it with two things. One, this is modeled after what the Michigan legislature did in 2016 on a similar initiative, and so I believe it was modeled after what they have done, and they have seen tremendous success from this type of board to help attain federal infrastructure dollars and just better coordination with infrastructure projects. But the second thing is that I, even myself as a Greater Minnesota member, have received feedback of inclusivity in the board and making sure regions are represented, areas are represented, different things like that. So my speculation is that there were a lot of folks that wanted to make sure they were represented, and perhaps it got a little unwieldy. So I certainly would be open to further conversations on making sure this is an appropriate size board.
Certainly we see the need for somebody to pay attention to infrastructure throughout the state, because it's not just state agencies. As we've traveled the state for 9 tours, 22 days, visiting 364 projects, we certainly saw that we're so far behind on our infrastructure. So I'm pleased to see at least some attempt to get a handle on that. Somebody taking leadership. Thank you, Senator Hochschild, to kind of take a look at this. I just hope that, and the idea of, what are we going to do about it? I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how in the world are we ever going to get caught up. You know, we've run into a problem with our MMB guidelines, which I, you know, as we've all been talking about that, our kind of frustration, because we see a great need out there. We've never bumped up against the third guideline, which is the amount of debt capacity the state can carry is limited, so that we save, you know, our ability to bond for the future, but, you know, the need is now to do it. And so I'm hoping that this council will kind of think creatively of, you know, do we need a special fund of some kind that we raise somehow that's going to help us with all this infrastructure? And I don't know, do you have all the commissioners represented? Probably all these commissioners don't need to be on it, because not all of them are really involved with intensively with, certainly admin is, deed in terms of paying out grants, and they have some small programs that they oversee. But, you know, and some of these state agency projects, nobody is really an advocate. I mean, who's an advocate for building and keeping up our 100-year-old prisons? You know, who's an advocate for what the courts have told us to do with the sex offender program? I mean, some of this stuff you just don't have a lot of support for. Yeah, it looks like every agency and every possible organization that represents local government is being consulted. Very inclusive. So at any rate, any other members have any comments? Or any thoughts about what else we might be able to do to tackle this problem? It's a big problem.
I would just, if I could just maybe give one last remark, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
I would just add that given the extreme rural nature of my district, I have a lot of communities that I think are looking at all of the investments that are out there, from federal bills that have passed to the bonding that we have passed here in the state, and they're wondering, how do I get some of that, right? How do we make sure that these ultra-rural communities that don't have the type of capacity that bigger communities have can access that? And then also, how are we thinking regionally, right? So we're not just these parochial cities and towns fighting for our fair share, but we're actually thinking strategically about going after these dollars. So my hope, Madam Chair, in part, is that this type of group in the right shape could help with some of that work.
Great. Oh, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the fiscal note, and I'm curious about the, never mind, it's absorbed. I saw the total staff cost, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, but I see it's absorbed. Congratulations. Well done.
Oh, it is, huh? Not all of it? Ms. Grunwald, you want to comment?
Madam Chair and members, so the fiscal note provided in your packet for Senate File 4108 provides some absorbed costs for staffing that is for the governor's office and the legislature. There's absorbed costs there. And then for Minnesota Management and Budget, there is some funding needed for an FTE to help establish the council. I believe it's 0.8 FTE. And then for the Minnesota Advisory Council on Infrastructure, for that council itself, there's some costs associated with space, salary, and tech needs for the council. So the fiscal note does have a overall cost of $248,000 in fiscal year 2025, and then $653,000 in fiscal year 2026, and then some ongoing funds as well. So there are a few absorbed costs and a few costs for other agencies.
Senator Nelson, you can't run a council for free.
Well, I think we have quite a few state employees that remain employed. So I have to say that is a disappointment. It looks like I didn't look far enough into that. So I guess that is always a concern. I'm going to tell you about the Metzen mantra. Some of you have heard that. How many state employees do we have already? And do we not think that any of those could take on these additional duties, or these duties instead of other duties that are no longer to be done? It's a bit of a rhetorical question, but I think it's one we should not lose sight of. And I do get somewhat concerned when every time we ask a state agency to do something different, there's a cost for an additional state employee. We love our state employees, but I'm just saying, In real life, you're not always doing everything that you used to do. The rest, of the world is getting very much more efficient. And I think we want to make sure that our state government does too.
Senator Nelson, you should have been in finance the other day when we have, it's a kind of bipartisan sport to criticize fiscal notes.
Okay.
Yeah, we definitely do. But we have given state employees a lot of work to do this last year.
Sure.
Senator Hochschild, then you have a second bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Chair Pappas, members, today I have Senate File 3758, a bill that modifies the Greater Minnesota Housing Infrastructure Program and provides funding to support the program. The Greater Minnesota Housing Infrastructure Program was established in the 2023 Housing Omnibus Bill. It allows the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to provide grants to cities outside the jurisdiction of the Met Council to cover up to 50% of capital costs of public infrastructure for workforce housing developments. Funding is eligible for single and multifamily developments. As I travel my district, I hear story after story from folks that cannot find the housing that they need to live in the rural communities that we have in northern Minnesota. And that simply is causing our populations to decrease. It's causing young families to not stay in the communities that they grew up. And it's also an impact on our employers who are trying to open up businesses and, in fact, large industry that may be looking to hire hundreds of employees being unable to do so because of the lack of housing. And oftentimes, in my opinion, rural communities tend to be the last place that receive funding through many statewide programs. So it's important that we create, in my mind, a dedicated fund for greater Minnesota workforce housing. And with that in mind, I do have two testifiers for you, Madam Chair. Scott McMahon with the Greater Minnesota Partnership and Jason Hale, who's the Executive Director of Cook County Housing and the Redevelopment Authority.
And welcome, Mr. McMahon. Please just repeat your name for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott McMahon, and I'm here today on behalf of the Greater Minnesota Partnership and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3768. I want to thank Senator Hochschild for bringing this bill forward, as well as the bill's co-authors, Senator Port, Frentz, Jasinski, and Nelson. Communities across Minnesota face a serious shortage of housing units. Minnesota Housing Finance estimates we need to build an additional 40,000 owner-occupied housing units, plus an additional 10,000 rental units above and beyond our normal annual rate of housing production in order to meet our housing demands. Unfortunately, communities in greater Minnesota face a unique challenge in building our share of the needed housing. Our housing market is simply in failure. In cities from War Road to Worthington and Austin to Pipestone, the cost to build a new housing unit is more than those units will appraise for once they're completed. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean. In July 2022, a new 37-unit apartment complex opened in Roseau. The building cost $6.5 million to build, and the day it opened, when it was completely full of renters, it appraised for $4 million. I'm working with a city in central Minnesota that is building a new 50-unit apartment building that will cost $9 million to build and will likely appraise at $6 million when it's done. If a single-family home costs $300,000 to build, it will only appraise for $250,000, so a young family will need to come up with a $50,000 down payment and a $50,000 finance gap just to get into that house. To close these gaps, cities use whatever local tools they can muster together, including tax abatement, TIF, fee waivers, land donation. We often see cash contributions from local industry, but often these tools stacked together are still not enough to close the fiscal gap. And when that happens, the housing project simply does not get built. This program is another tool that cities can use to stack it in the financing package, and it is probably the most appropriate one since our market failure begins with our public infrastructure. To build a new single-family lot, it costs upwards of $80,000 to build the infrastructure, streets, sewers, utilities, and more than $300,000 for larger multifamily development. But once that public infrastructure is built, the land is worth far less than $80,000 or $360,000. For example, in one city recently, the city built out the public infrastructure to create a few developable lots for single-family homes. It cost the city $80,000 to do it per lot, and the completed lots were valued at only $17,000. The funds in this program, leveraged against a dollar-for-dollar local match, will help close the financing gaps on housing projects in the four corners of the state, will help our employers hire more employees, expand in our communities and in communities across Minnesota, and help grow the state's tax base, a benefit for all Minnesotans. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. McMahon. Are there any questions? Right, then I think the second testifier is Mr. Jason Hale, Executive Director of Cook County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. He's joining us via Zoom. Welcome, Mr. Hale. Oh, we can't hear you.
I was talking to the void. Can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to talk about Senate File 3768. My thanks to Senator Hochschild for facilitating this important bill and conversation. Again, my name is Jason Hale, Executive Director of the Cook County HRA. I regret that I could not be with you in person today. I've had the privilege of working on local government real estate and development projects for about 10 years in this great state. During that time, I have watched construction costs steadily increase every year, hoping and thinking they have to go down next year, And as you probably can assume, they have not. They have continued to increase. Unfortunately, with the higher interest rate environment we contend with, building the housing that we need, as other speakers have already alluded to, has never been more expensive or more challenging. For those unfamiliar with the North Shore, Cook County is the northeasternmost county in the state. We have Lake Superior to our east, Canada to the north, the Boundary Waters, Canoe Area, and National Forests to the west. We are Minnesota's outdoor playground, where a population of 5,600 hosts about 1.5 million visitors every year. We are also the last 50 feet of the last mile for distribution. And like most communities across the state, we have a housing problem. In fact, Cook County has the least affordable housing in Minnesota. The median sale price of homes is about 5.5 times the median household income. As of 3 p.m. today, there were only two single-family homes available for under $500,000 within 30 minutes of Grand Marais, which is the only city in our county. Our housing challenges in rural Minnesota are not unique, but they are different. The open fields of southern Minnesota, where I grew up, provide ample room for construction, theoretically, but this is at the expense of productive farmland and also limited utility access. Maybe the home prices in the Iron Range or in Silver Bay, for example, seem like a bargain to residents of the 7-county metro area, but building new entry-level homes often doesn't pencil there, as Scott had just alluded to. They simply have fewer resources, both financial and regarding skilled workers, which often results in an impossible math problem. I don't think anybody in the esteemed committee is surprised to hear that housing is difficult and expensive. That is a pretty well an established fact at this point. In Cook County, however, everything's just a little bit harder. For example, there's no natural gas in all of the county. Silver Bay, which is an hour away from Grand Marais, is the end of the line. And again, it is the only city in Cook County, so consequently, it is the only place where public utilities are actually available. Cook County is larger than the state of Rhode Island, yet less than 1% of that area provides public utilities. Still, in housing and development, we go where there's opportunity. So the Cook County HRA is working on several multifamily projects in the city of Grand Marais. Of course, there is need throughout the county for housing, but building one house without utilities means it costs about $60,000 to get a driveway, utilities, internet in. This doesn't include the cost of the land, much less the foundation and the rest of the house. Even within city limits, the cost of infrastructure can be pretty astounding. For example, a local nonprofit I'm working with is trying to build two very modest single-family homes on two adjacent lots in city limits. They want to build and sell them to income-qualified households and are targeting around $250,000 as a sale price, trying to break even. But the project stalled this last year because it will cost them $80,000 to extend the utilities. The HRA, of course, continues to work with them. We're trying to reduce those costs, but small rural communities have limited resources. And the infrastructure in Grand Marais serves over 1 million people a year, while the city has 1,340 residents that have to maintain that infrastructure. We all know that local governments have limited tools in our toolbox. While we had an incredible year for housing last year, thank you again for that, many rural communities still struggle to access those important new funds. We don't always have the type of projects that those programs are designed for. It is difficult to get developers to build in our communities, especially in outlying Greater Minnesota. And our products often cost more, simply due to economies of scale and logistical problems. Infrastructure is the one thing that every housing project needs. The additional $20 million of this proposed bill for infrastructure will not solve the problem, but I believe this is an all-hands-on-deck moment for Minnesota with regard to housing, and Senate File 3768 will help. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Hale? Thank you very much. I did have a question, Senator Hochschild. Didn't we put like $1 billion into housing last year, but this program wasn't funded? Or are you seeking additional funds?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question and members. Last year, we did $35 million total for Greater Minnesota Housing between bonding and housing. Mm-hmm.
So it's just an ongoing need. You just are looking for more funding for it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Nelson, then Senator Dibble. Oh, Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I think this program specifically last year in the housing bill received $5 million on a one-time basis.
Right.
In the housing bill?
Yes.
Just $5
million? $5 million on a one-time basis.
Right.
Last year. Yeah.
Right. Thanks. And then there was more money in other bills for it? Yeah, Mr. McMahon.
So, Madam Chair, Senators, there was $5 million in the housing bill for this. There was $3 million in the bonding bill
for this.
I can tell you when those bills got signed, with the number of phone calls that we received in our offices, I can tell you that money could be spent about half an hour with the demand and the interest that this program has across Greater Minnesota.
Senator Nelson, and then Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if, I was just looking it up here, but I think it'd be important, since this is funding for the Greater Minnesota Housing Infrastructure Grant Program, if maybe you just gave a brief overview of that, what that program is, and maybe our staff might be able to do that. I'm looking it up here, 462A.395. Just give a brief overview, or maybe that's not the place for the bonding committee, but I think it's important just to know a bit about the grant program that we're talking about.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. I'm sorry, Senator Nelson, staff is talking to me.
I was just asking for a brief overview of the Greater Minnesota Infrastructure Grant Program.
So,
brief overview.
Okay, Senator Hochschild.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Nelson, and also thank you, Senator Nelson, for being on this bill, and Senator Jasinski as well. So I'm going to do my best here. So the funding is eligible for single-family and multifamily housing, and the a city is capped at $500,000 for the project. Eligible projects include sewer, water supply systems, utility extension, street wastewater treatment, stormwater management, and other publicly owned physical infrastructure. And municipalities cover 50% of the infrastructure costs.
And I think that's everything. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senators, the other thing with it is the grants are capped at under this bill, it would increase from $30,000 to $40,000
yes.
per single-family lot. The local government would be responsible for the match on it. Multifamily, given the fact you're dealing with a lot more toilet sinks and showers, that grant cap is $180,000, again, with the 50-50 match from the local community.
Thank you.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I had for either the bill author or any of his testifiers would be, sometimes programs that are designated for Greater Minnesota, like I believe this program, it's, you know, any community outside of the seven county metropolitan area is eligible, that sometimes the housing dollars can be concentrated in some of the larger regional centers in Greater Minnesota. And doesn't and the smaller rural communities sometimes have a harder time competing. I don't know if that's a concern with this program or if you see good balance, because I've heard from other programs where they're oftentimes designated for Greater Minnesota that your larger and frankly, you know, urban regional centers will be getting that money and the rural communities can be left behind. So I just wanted to see if that's a concern with this program or perhaps not.
Senator Hochschild.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Senator Rasmussen. That's an equal concern with me on programs like this and many other programs, so I've heard similar things. I might pass it to my testifier, Mr. McMahon, to kind of give more insight on that.
Mr. McMahon.
Madam Chair, Senators, so it is a concern. When we created the program last year, we wanted to see the dollars get out to all corners of the state, and so that's one of the reasons why there is that $500,000 max per community over a two-year period, so it doesn't just get concentrated in one area. So we hope it's an incentive for MHFA to distribute those dollars across the state. We do know in conversation with MHFA that they are focused on getting the dollars, A, where they can have the biggest impact, and B, where we can have a geographic spread around it. So we're optimistic that the dollars will get out across all communities. We're also open to language that that would help put those values into state statute as well.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Hochschild, and to the testifier for that conversation. And I think that's something to consider perhaps in this language is, I don't think we want to exclude any communities, but I know oftentimes larger communities can perhaps get the per unit costs down because they're building larger residential developments or other things that help spread the cost out. And so sometimes the smaller rural communities that are trying to have a smaller expansion can sometimes be disadvantaged. So I appreciate that conversation. And Senator Housechild, your concern over that issue as well. So thank you.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Housechild. Again, this bill, I'm on it. I think it's a great bill. I talked about earlier when we were talking about the manufacturing home, the same issue going on with single family. The costs have just gone up dramatically for the improvements, and I just want us to remember what some of those costs drive that. It's things like paid family leave, increasing gas tax. I mean, all these things are causing our things to increase, and here we're helping money to do that. But again, if you look at the overall root of what's costing these increases, there's a lot of things that the legislature seems to have been putting in place. So I think it's great because I think we need it out there. But let's remember what's driving some of these increasing costs on these developments is things that we can control here, and sometimes we're not doing that. But again, thank you for allowing me to be on the bill. I think it's a great bill, but we do have to remember why these costs, what the root of the problem is. We're putting a Band-Aid on this by giving them money, but the root of the cost is things are increasing by some regulations that have been put on them recently. So just my comments, but again, I think it's a great bill.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
All right, the next bill we have is SF-3782, Chair Pappas.
Members, these next few bills are really works in progress, in process. So I don't expect us to act on them at all today. We're still evolving. We need more time for staff to look them over. We need to get more input. So just kind of keep that in mind, because there are certainly our concerns, but we're trying to get at some problems that we ran into during the bonding tour. So the first one, 3782, I do have an oral amendment on this one that the request of the state auditor, and that is, my oral amendment is on page 1, line 18, delete shall and insert may. I'll move
Chair
that.
Chair Pappas has a oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The oral amendment passes.
So, Madam Chair, what we're trying to get at with this bill is the whole issue that we've run into across the state where some cities really have kind of a repair and replacement and maintenance account, and they're using their enterprise fund from their water and sewer fees to do that. And some communities, for whatever reason, are not doing that. And we really ran into where these systems were built 50, 70 years ago, 95% funded by the federal government, and maybe there was the expectation that when they ended their useful life, that the federal government would come in and do the replacement. And we're certainly not seeing that. And so it's really been falling on us. They've come to us for help. And some are, we require 50% match. So, that's kind of a given. Some communities are not able to do that. And some don't even ask because, they've been putting the money aside to a certain extent. They have a reserve fund. They've been keeping good maintenance up. And then maybe they're willing to also pass their local bonds to pay for it themselves. And then there's the others that for whatever reason haven't done that. And I understand with some of the small communities that don't have a good property tax base, that's been a challenge for them probably to just keep up with their maintenance. And so we always ask them, right, what are your water and sewer fees? When did you start raising them in anticipation of having to do this replacement? How much is your reserve fund and what's your debt capacity? And so I think these bills are trying to get at whether this is too prescriptive, and I think some of the local governments probably feel they are, or whether they feel they're not really fair. Some arguments might be that we're a regional service, that especially a road, for example, and I'm not even sure that this should apply to roads because we have such a partnership with how we pay for roads. We have the local road and bridge fund, we have some are trunk highways, some are federally funded, but I'm mostly concerned about kind of the water and sewer. So that could be a change we could make here. So just some kind of a plan I'm thinking of that they have, and that on the MMB form we ask them to tell us, you know, not in great detail, but at least to a certain extent, that we have been putting money aside or we have plans for local bonding, and then maybe that might reduce the amount of money at least they would need for us, because we're hardly ever able to make the 50%. We say 50%, and I think they kind of count on that. But you've heard me say that if your 50% is 8 or 10 million, that's a lot of money for us to do. And now we're facing, last year was a banner year, expectations are high, and now we're facing an issue where we have a lot more limited dollars to help these local communities. So that's basically what the first bill is. And I think that there are some local communities that do want to come in on 3782.
Okay, we've got two testifiers. The first one is Mr. Bradley Peterson.
And maybe they have a better idea, which I'm open to.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And I do appreciate Senator Pappas's comments that this is a work in progress and that there is perhaps more work to be done. And we do appreciate also, too, the problem that she is trying to tackle, because cities across the state take very seriously their obligations to be good stewards of public tax dollars as well as public infrastructure. I think it's important to recognize that when a local government is asking for assistance with the costs of a local project, especially when we're talking about core infrastructure like water or wastewater treatment, it is often because of the high costs involved already that put a significant strain on local resources to do those projects. The requirements of this bill would also put additional pressure on local property taxpayers and ratepayers who are not only paying higher taxes and fees to support the city's local match, but will now be burdened with additional taxes and fees to support the replacement funds that this bill would call for. I think it should also be noted that, and Senator Pappas did note, that the benefit of the project may extend far beyond the immediate jurisdiction that is building or maintaining the project. So in the case of a wastewater project, for instance, the environmental benefits of clean water go to the region and other parts of the state, but it is the residents and businesses of the local government that will be solely tasked with the burden of maintaining the replacement fund. Additionally, depending on the type of infrastructure, this sort of requirement may be duplicative. So for instance, for many DNR grants, local governments are already required to have a maintenance and replacement plan kind of in place before they can get the grants. We're also concerned that these requirements in the bill as it currently is stated relate only to local governments. In recent years, we've seen a significant amount of monies go to nonprofits for their capital needs. And so we think that any requirement that would apply to a local government should also apply to other recipients of state dollars. Finally, the requirements of a bill like this could deepen the divide between wealthy communities and poor local governments. But as Senator Pappas indicated, this is something that is continuing to be worked on. We appreciate that, and we're happy to participate in any way that we can.
All right, thank you. Next we have...
Sorry,
Senator Dibble.
I apologize. I didn't realize we had more testifiers. I'll make a comment after testifying. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Next, we have testifier Mr. Craig Johnson.
While Mr. Johnson is coming up, I do want to mention that the Government Finance Officers Association, this is in line with their best practices, that local governments should establish capital asset renewal and replacement reserve policies to help them manage their substantial investments in capital improvements. So it's kind of good government.
Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just wanted to keep my comments fairly brief because we will be working on this in the future together and look forward to doing that. Just to be clear, cities already have a tremendous interest in asset management. We're responsible for the public health and safety of our residents, and water and wastewater are the core public health and safety that allows there to be a city there. Without that, Not only is there not a functional city there, but all of the pollution from the people who do live there is coming right down the river to here. So we work very hard on that, and it's a very important problem, and it's why the state has had such a big role in helping cities meet those needs over the years, because it's a requirement. Secondly, cities do long-term planning. A city does have certain capacities, depending on their tax base, to do capital improvement programs where they put aside money for the new fire hall, they put aside money for the upgrade to City Hall or the regional center that they've got there for community events. But the cost of water and wastewater systems dwarfs anything you could do with capital improvement programs. It just takes too much money. The example I can give you, just so you see how it works, is nobody's getting free money to do this. If you are a community and you need to improve your water or wastewater system, you bring your plan in, it gets approved as being adequate to meet all of the regulations and requirements, and then it is evaluated based on what is the cost of that plan, how many people do you have, and what is the tax base you have and their income level. And you then have to raise your utility rates to a level that is deemed to be the maximum that that community can handle, and then And that's ongoing, that's not just for a year or something. And then you are eligible to get a grant for what's beyond that. So we're already asking cities from PFA, the Public Facilities Authority, mm-hmm. who is the banker for all of our water infrastructure. Either loans or grants go through them typically, unless you are a city that has their own financing capacities through other sources. So we do really work to make sure that cities are only getting that kind of help if it's a city that has already kind of been stretched to their maximum capacity. And if you hear a city is eligible for grants under the WIF program, you know that they are already paying very high water and sewer rates, usually several times a month higher than what many of us are used to paying. You just haven't seen it until you get out to those smaller communities.
We've seen it.
You've seen it, but it can easily be $50 or $60 a month mm-hmm. for water and another $50 or $60 mm-hmm. for sewer, right. Where me in Burnsville, I pay $32 a month for water, sewer, stormwater, lights, sidewalks, and recycling. So it's a little bit different when you're trying to get eligible for those programs. The only other things I would add is we do think there are ways that we can get the help we need out there, because there are cities that do not have the staffing necessary to be doing advanced asset management planning on their own. That was part of the discussion that was related to Senator Hochschild's bill earlier about that sustainability task force. Senator Jasinski got to sit in on some of those fun summer meetings we had. I don't know if that's the right way to do it, but there is definitely a need for the state to step in and say, hey, we've got some resources to help you smaller cities figure out how to better do this, and potentially even connect them with the financing that would get that done. The Pollution Control Agency has a program the legislature have funded that takes small communities that have lagoon wastewater systems and is working with them to optimize those ponds so that those plants can be continued in their life and not have to be replaced, keep the lower technology wastewater treatment in place instead of having to put in a new expansive, you know, mechanical system that costs hundreds of times more. So I think those kinds of things are the types of areas we can look at to maximize asset management and preservation. And we certainly welcome the discussion because it is an important thing. But many of these cities have had their system running for 70 or more years. And it's just patched together, and they're going to need the help. So thank you very much. We look forward to working with the chair as we discuss this and how to move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, questions or discussions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Senator Pappas for bringing this idea forward. I think this was the product of some of our observations as we toured the state this year and had ensuing conversation on the bus as we were tootling around. A little surprised at the testimony of the representatives of local units of government. I think they would not step forward with such objections, but would want to really encourage a policy like this. Absolutely, many of the cities around the state do a great job. And I don't think Senator Pappas is suggesting that the state wouldn't step forward either through financing mechanisms or the PFA or, you know, outright geo bonding support or grants and the like. We understand that the level of need is disproportional to the ability for a lot of communities to support their infrastructure. So we help the state, our communities, help other communities that might need that kind of intensive capital infrastructure support because they don't have the property tax wealth or the population to support that sort of thing. But just like we see with condo associations, they have a requirement to do a capital study and to put away sufficient funds for capital reserve so that the condo association owners aren't shocked with a gigantic surprise special assessment when it's time to tuck point the building or redo a major renovation and replacement of an HVAC system. That all should have been anticipated to some degree, and money should have been put away for a number of years. And that's a requirement in the law, and a lot of condo associations simply don't do that. A lot of cities simply aren't putting away some money to anticipate some of their, to deal with their ongoing capital maintenance needs and or anticipate and participate more fully in the major capital replacements that pop up from time to time. And then some have this philosophical perspective that they don't do debt. And so they haven't put anything away, and so they're coming in for extraordinary asks that are just so out of proportion to what other communities around the state are doing. So it's about making sure that everyone is kind of doing the responsible and prudent thing, and would hope that the local units of government would be more participatory in this idea instead of what I felt was fairly resistant in their testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of continuing on that, again, I was with Senator Pappas, and we see that a lot of things like that. So I think it is a concern. We'd like to do that. And when we get some huge funding for some trails, when we were in the city, I always was concerned you get this federal grant for a trail. Well, you get that, but then 10 or 15 years down, you have to replace it or seal coat it or do those things like that. So I understand the intent, and I'm glad it's a working process. And I think the enterprise funds, as has been mentioned, that's an easier thing to do. You can build it into your rates. You have a sinking fund, and you can continue to do that. But there's other things that don't have that. And when I was on the city council and mayor for many, many years, we spent hours and hours working on our CIP to decide what was 20 years out, what's 10 years out, what's 5 years out, almost like the stip in the chip that the Department of Transportation does. But so I think each city council does that. Some are probably good at it. Some are probably not so good. I think incentivizing to do it is one thing, and we should do that. But actually requiring them and making it up to MMB to determine that amount, I think, is a little over excessive. I think each individual city should do that responsibly and do that, but obviously send out some, education on doing that. Mm-hmm. But we've also done, like, as I think one testifier brought, we have nonprofits, we have the colleges, we've done, ice arenas, we've done community centers. Mm-hmm. I think if you're going to do it for the cities, you should be doing the same thing for these other nonprofits, because that's just as important. Because I've seen many projects, they do that, and then all of a sudden they're coming back and saying, well, we need money for windows and roofs and things like that. So I don't think it should apply just to the municipalities if we're going to do it that way. And many cities are strapped. I mean, they don't have the money to do that, to do those things. I don't want to belabor on the point, but, paid family leave and all these things, new things that are being put on the cities, they're going to have to fund those. And to have extra money to do that, they're going to have to raise the taxes for their local people. So, it has to be paid for. I like the plan of doing it, but I think we want to really look at how we're doing that, because there's, again, many, like I said, the colleges. I mean, if we get we funded a new chemistry lab for the UMD several years ago. We're not requiring them to put away a set aside as like this as well, I don't believe. So, again, I like the plan. I think it's important, but I will tell you, city councils, most city councils do spend a lot of time on capital improvements. We spent weeks when I was there of deciding how we're going to make sure we're planning for future replacements and things like that. So, again, I think the idea is well, but I want to be careful how we do it to make sure we're not penalizing just the municipalities and not other institutions that are getting the funding. So, thank you.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Pappas, for bringing forward, I think, this important conversation. And I think, to Mr. Peterson and Mr. Johnson, at least one of my takeaways from the bonding tour is I believe that we can sometimes create perverse incentives for local communities to not be regularly investing in their infrastructure, because if they come to this committee with a dire situation, they're perhaps more likely to get state bonding dollars. They might even do better on the PFA listing. And so for communities that are year after year, decade after decade, making regular investments in their infrastructure, saving for major replacements, are they in some ways being punished for good behavior and mm-hmm. actually not getting their fair share of state dollars because mm-hmm. they have been more prudent with managing their assets and infrastructure? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I would ask, you know, the groups that offered some opposition to this to think about, are there metrics where we can look at communities and if they have been investing enough in their infrastructure or if they're effectively asking this committee for a bailout? I think we do recognize the extraordinary costs with some of these projects, and sometimes they're unplanned, and I think that's where the state should step in to help these communities that are in a very difficult situation. But I want to make sure we're not incentivizing poor fiscal management from local units of government or perhaps even state agencies that frankly haven't been planning appropriately for asset replacement. So I think this conversation is really important for us to get right, especially given the needs that we're seeing across the state, and to make sure that we're making the most of state dollars. So thank you, Senator Pappas. And,
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Rasmussen. And then I can give another perspective, is you have a city which was badly managed, you know, and that the city council did not also manage well. And then you have a new group that comes in, a new mayor, a new city administrator, and they go, oh my goodness, they don't have a reserve fund. They haven't been saving for any of this. And I remember we visited somewhere, I don't remember where it was now, and the city administrator said, we're really so sorry that our previous, you know, management didn't do this, and we're going to now really do a really good job in managing our project, but, you know, in the meantime, can you give us $5 million? Because that money wasn't set aside or wasn't saved or it wasn't managed well. So I think that that's another problem, is that the people in charge now may not be the ones that screwed up. Yeah.
Senator Nelson.
I thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I am glad you brought this forward and did start this discussion. And that's how I think just having this discussion publicly is also going to have an impact locally as well. And I would just add a couple other things as we're thinking about this. So clearly well-intended, and I think every one of us on bonding committee tours thought, well, wow, how did things get so uncared for? Why weren't they maintained better? No matter where it was, sometimes you wonder about those things, and we don't know all the financial things that go into those individual communities. But I would add just a couple other things, because I think this conversation will continue. And a couple other things to add to that are some places have areas that have a lot of statewide significance or mm-hmm. regional significance. And so as we would look at those type mm-hmm. of assets, of course, we'd want to think about a bit differently. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things we do in the bonding committees. Mm-hmm. We look at statewide and regional assets. So when it comes to that type of mandatory replacement preservation fund, we'd have to consider all of those things as well. And then also speaking to Senator Rasmussen's point about metrics, I like the fact, Senator Pappas, that as we were on those, many of those bonding tour visits, you asked for kind of like a set of metrics mm-hmm. for every, especially when it came to water, mm-hmm. Wastewater. And I think those are important, and I'd like to see them right in that bonding proposal
right.
if we had those for every community. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I thought, sometimes I think we got it, but sometimes we didn't, that I also thought was really important is noticing that every city, every locale is very different in every way, including economically. And so I liked one of the metrics that I found very helpful was what percent of average income mm-hmm. is this water bill, or what percent of average income is this sewer charge? And mm-hmm. I think those are really great metrics mm-hmm. that maybe we could package as part of our mm-hmm. Bonding requirements that we send out, and we ask people to fill that out for us. I just found that incredibly helpful.
And the auditor's asset preservation thing, whatever she does, also asks those questions. It's just that the information isn't always as up to date as we need. I wanted to mention another complication that's kind of no fault of the local community, and that is the changing standards for chemicals. They may have PFAS, manganese, nitrates, lead in their water, and you know, science is evolving. They find out these things are more dangerous at a higher level, and the Pollution Control Agency or the Health Department requires them now to upgrade their treatment plants. And so I think that that also is a case that they can make that, you know, we've been prudent, we've planned for our infrastructure replacement, but not for this higher level that now you're holding us to, and we have to build new plants for that purpose. So it's a complicated issue, but my major goal is that they do have some kind of a plan in place. They can't always predict, you know, like some new chemical is going to come up that's going to be a problem for them, or a weather incident or whatever, or bad design or bad construction. That has happened, too, to some people. But.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, because we've all been on, I think all of us have been on the bonding tour for a while now, and I've been on it for 8 years. And I think it's Senator Rasmussen's point. Sometimes we go into a facility and look at it, it's like, well, you know, there's buckets all over and the rainwater is coming down. There's some simple things you would think they could be doing. I don't say it seems staged, but at some things, it's almost like the worse it looks, the more they get priority to it. and I think all of us, I think I know for sure, and maybe you can over the years, 8 years of thinking, well, you think they could do a little bit more maintenance to make it look a little bit better. And it was almost like it was staged to make it look worse. And then it creates the higher priority. So I think if we continue to incentivize these local units of government, universities, you name it, to maintain the things a little bit better. And I know they're money strapped on some things, but there's many things that I've seen over the last 8 years that they could do some small repairs to make it much more better or much better than the actual condition it's in when we come on a tour. I don't want to say it's staged, but it seems like they make it look like it's worse than it could have been maintained doing some of that, just again to prioritize their things or something like that. But I know we've all done it, so I just wanted to bring it up as part of this whole conversation to make it better. We got to look at making sure that we're incentivizing to take better care of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, for bringing this bill forward. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the future bonding bill. And so next we have, as amended, next, we have SF-3784, Chair Pappas.
Madam Chair, this, I talked a little bit about our, we have guidelines terms of bonding, borrowing guidelines that MMB has talked about. And local government also have, should if they don't already, they have debt management guidelines. So that was another one of our questions that we have had on the bonding tour is, what is your local debt capacity? And I was just thinking that this would actually be good if it was on the MMB form. I mean, we developed a system Ms. Carlson did where she would send out questions ahead of time. So that's how, as the bonding tours evolved, you saw a lot more communities giving us the information we really needed, because we told them in advance what we were gonna ask them. But this debt capacity is another one that it's a simple bill. I think we have a little amendment for it, an A1 amendment. Madam Chair, I will move the A1 amendment. I think this is something that Ms. James, Ms. James, is just a grammatical thing, or what is it?
Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, just a technical correction.
Technical.
I think that the provision is looking for the debt that is outstanding as of the date, and not debt that they've ever incurred, some of which might have been paid off.
That's correct.
Okay. Chair Pappas moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted.
So Chair once Pappas. Again, it just adds debt capacity to the list of information that they're required to provide to the Commissioner of Management Budget, and then we get those forms and we'll see that on the form.
Sounds good. We've got one testifier today.
Oh.
Mr. Craig Johnson, please come up, introduce yourself again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Actually do not have any concerns about this being an item that needs to be added onto the application. It's a factual number. It's already required to be in city financial annual reports and other places. So it should not take
particularly any extra work to generate by a city if they are attempting to go after these resources. The thing that I do want to remind people of, though, is just because there is a capacity of 3%, which is similar for local government, does not mean it's even wise for the city to go to that level. And in particular, if it's a city that does have some higher property values, what that would leverage for debt for that community could make their property taxes ridiculously high, trying to meet 3% of their total property value in debt. You would never want to go that high. Most cities also try to reserve as much of their debt capacity as they can in case of an emergency need, so that they have the capacity to get money in case of a difficult situation with infrastructure. So that was the only points I wanted to make, Madam Chair, and happy to work with the author on all of these ideas as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Members, any questions or discussions? All right, good, because we only have 20 minutes left. We still have two more items. Thank you.
It's a short.
Senator Pappas, any closing remarks or anything else before?
No, we'll just
okay.
lay it over.
So on this particular bill, it will be laid over for possible inclusion in the future bonding bill. The next bill we have is SF4845, Chair Pappas.
Madam Chair and members, this was a request from Minnesota Management and Budget to just change the date of their cancellation report when it's due from January to February, and I wanted to send this on its own to the Finance Committee.
Okay.
And I don't know if we need to hear, I don't know if Mr. Anderson's here. Do we
Sounds
need
good.
To,
yep. So we have one testifier today, Mr. Eric Anderson. Please come up and introduce yourself.
He said he doesn't need to testify.
All right. Members, any questions or discussion on this particular bill? Senator Dibble.
Yeah, I'm sure this is because people don't want to work over the holiday week. I'm sure that's the reason, and that's we run into this a lot. So whenever you're like putting due dates on reports and things like that, members, just keep an eye on the January 1st. I mean, someone's working over Christmas, New Year's, holidays, and we don't want that. So thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 4845 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Chair Pappas moves that 4845 is recommended to pass and refer to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The bill is adopted and passed. Let's see here. Next, we've got...
Madam Chair, this does not have a bill number.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just it'll be an amendment to the omnibus bill. And the idea here is similar to what we've done with, I think, the lottery money and legacy money. This would require that recipients of a grant of state bonds for a capital project or of funds or of cash for a capital project clearly display a notice that states the project was fiscally supported with state taxes. And it could have a logo, MMB could oversee the development of a logo, and it would be, they have to display the logo and identify the project as funded with a grant of state money from taxes collected statewide. I think sometimes the local communities think that this is kind of free money, and they need to know that this is actually tax dollars that is from everyone in the state of Minnesota that is helping them with their local project. So what do you think about that idea?
So before I go to members, I'll just say that I think this is such a fantastic idea. And I know that as we were touring our bonding tour, we heard so many communities say, well, we never get help from the state. Well, they actually do, but they just don't know that they did, probably because it's not as communicated to the communities that they are getting, they have historically gotten dollars from the state and invested into their communities. And I think having this is a good way to let people know when we are investing in their communities that we have. Members, any questions or comments or discussions on this?
Madam Chair, just notice I didn't say that that this is funded by the Capital Investment Committee chaired by Senator Sandy Pappas and list all your all your names. I did not do that, but if you want me to, we could do that.
I have
that.
An amendment, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Have you seen that? County commissioners or city council members have done that. I have seen that.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Pappas. I guess, is there a threshold for when this notice would be required. And like, I'll just give out an example. If an HVAC system at a Minnesota State campus is upgraded through HEPR, like, is there some threshold where notice would have to be provided?
Chair Pappas.
That's an excellent question about, you know, should we have a threshold? And I actually hadn't even thought about HEPR. But that is something that we do fund. Good point.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Pappas. And one other thing to think about, too, this is more of just like a general comment, and I think it's important that we recognize that the members of this committee are not funding projects. Even the legislature is not necessarily funding projects, but this is really Minnesota tax dollars. And so it is the people's money that's building this project. That's not, you know, necessarily coming from this committee or even from the legislature. It's coming from Minnesotans who are paying taxes. And so I appreciate the idea of, you know, bringing some notice to this, but you know, ultimately, these public buildings, whether they're paid for with local tax dollars or are coming through a state appropriation, you know, they're the taxpayers' dollars. It's not necessarily, you know, the committee that's writing the check.
Senator Rasmussen, though, you're absolutely right, and that's what the language says. Mm-hmm. It's funded with a grant of state money from taxes collected statewide. So I think that is a real, you're right, it's not just like the money just appears at the legislature. We get the money from somewhere. So I do like that language.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do like the language as well. It does remind me a little bit of the Clean Water Legacy dollars.
Right, that's the idea. That it,
and that is forever cemented mm-hmm. in Minnesotans' mind mm-hmm. that those, that extra sales tax dollar goes to these type of things. And so I think it is maybe it's just the teacher in me, but I think it's a little bit of a education, mm-hmm. an opportunity to just educate and say, this is an example of your state tax dollars at work.
Right.
So I like it.
That would be another way you could say it, an example of your state tax dollars at work. That's another way, yeah. We could think about that. I do think, though, that we should think about, if you think of any other examples, like what should we do with HEPR projects or kind of smaller contributions, should there be a threshold that if it's 500,000 or more or, you know, something like that?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Well, just, you know, off the cuff, it seems to me that if there's a visible place to make that known, that's a good thing to do, but I don't know where you would make that known on an HVAC unit, for example. Mm-hmm. So they're very important. We really miss it when they're not working. But I think that is something to further delve mm-hmm. into and determine. I think Senator Rasmussen did ask some good questions there about that.
Madam Chair, it does say that on Subdivision 3 that if it's a drinking water or wastewater infrastructure, the notice is in the city utility building statements, so you don't have to put up a sign if that's an alternative. So anyway, another work in progress, process, whatever.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, for bringing this bill forward. I don't see anything else on the agenda, but I'm going to let Senator Pappas take over as chair, and she can decide if she's going to let us out early.
You can adjourn the meeting. Go ahead.
All right. So with nothing else before us, I'd like to go ahead and adjourn the meeting.